Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Born to Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka. Conversations plus connections equals community. Those are my three C's. The heart of my show is, what's your story? It's my belief we all have stories. Some are similar, others are uniquely different. Storytelling brings the passions of my guests to life through our conversations. So be prepared to be entertained, informed, and inspired. Welcome to today's show. Hi, everybody, and thank you for joining me today. My guest today is Dr. John Berger. He's a PhD. He's an environmental science and policy specialist, and he's the author of an amazing book called Solving the Climate Crisis. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you very much, Marcia. I really appreciate you inviting me to talk with you today.
You bet. So let's start off. I like to always make this a little bit personal, if you don't mind. So I know a little bit about you and your background, but I thought you could just share a little bit about yourself for our listeners.
I'd be happy to do that. I grew up in New York City. We lived in downtown Manhattan in the heart of the city where there was mostly cement and a few street trees. So I didn't have any opportunity really to encounter the environment with a capital E apart from Central Park. But as I was growing up, my parents moved to the outskirts of the city, and we lived in an area where I had plenty of opportunity to roam around in nature and to appreciate the plants and the flowers and the insect life, the fireflies at night, and
yes,
the praying mantises. And nature was quite robust and healthy when I was young and growing up. And this was back in the mid-1950s. So at that time, I had a kindly neighbor who took me on walks by the Hudson River and picked wild strawberries. And as I got, wild raspberries. And as I got older, I went on canoe trips in the Adirondacks and camped and fished and got a pretty intense experience of the outdoors. And then when I was 16, my parents gave me a book called Our National Parks, which was put out by the National Geographic Society. And that really excited my imagination about nature and wilderness and the high mountains. When I moved to California to go to college, I had a chance to go out into nature and explore the wilderness and the national parks and the regional parks and the coastline. And I fell pretty deeply in love with nature and have a passion for protecting nature and the environment. And so that was one way that I got started in being interested in nature. But my interest in climate didn't come along till actually decades later. And there was kind of a professional progression that I went through in which I first focused on energy and the environmental impacts of energy technology. And I was concerned about the impacts of nuclear power. Back in the 1970s, the Nixon administration had the plan to build 1,000 nuclear power plants. This was kind of the dream of those who were proposing nuclear power as an energy solution. And because I wrote a book called Nuclear Power, The Unviable Option, A Critical Look at Our Energy Alternatives, I did a lot of study for the second part of the book, which was clean energy alternatives. So I was familiar with clean energy alternatives going back to the early 1970s. And I pursued my interest in energy, and I went back to school, and I got a master's in energy and natural resources. And I had already gone to work for David Brower, the conservation leader, at Friends of the Earth. And from Friends of the Earth, I went on to found, or rather to co-found, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service to provide public information about the problems with nuclear technology and the advantages of clean energy technology.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequently, I got into working in the field of environmental restoration. And from environmental restoration and understanding clean energy and renewable power technologies, I then, with that background, began learning about climate change. And this was about 1980, 1981. And I remember introducing some students of mine at Vista College to climate change as an issue. And the part of it that really caught my attention was sea level rise at that point and what would happen if the polar ice caps melted and if low-lying areas were inundated. And so I lived with that awareness. It heightened as I listened in the late 1980s to Dr. James Hansen, who was kind of recognized internationally as the scientist who first said that there is a discernible human impact on the climate and that we people are heating the climate. This was not just a natural climate perturbation that occurs throughout, you know, geological time.
Mm-hmm.
So
quite a background, my friend.
I haven't even gotten to climate change, really. I started writing about it.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that, and I want to make sure that you have ample time to really discuss that, because you have written several books, and you have your latest book is called Solving the Climate Crisis. You state that in America, we're wasting between 30% and 50% of the energy used in buildings today. Is that something that's fixable?
It is fixable, Marcia, if we set our minds to fixing it. And the first thing that we can do is make sure that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past by building new buildings that are dependent in any way on fossil fuels. We need to be building net zero buildings, meaning that they produce no net carbon dioxide and they generate their own energy either on the rooftop if it's a small building, or that they draw renewable energy from the power grid if it's a larger building, and that within the building all the appliances are absolutely state-of-the-art, as efficient mm-hmm. as possible, and that the heating system is ground source geothermal, and that there's sort of sensitivity to the outdoor temperature, and so buildings are properly, the temperature cycling of the building is properly managed, computer controlled, and there are various other technical solutions to energy use in a building. It's relatively easy in a new building and doesn't add much to the initial cost of the building, but then saves a lot of money over the life cycle of the
mm-hmm.
building. The existing building stock, 106 million buildings, is a much more difficult challenge to face. And there, we actually need state and federal and municipal funding in the form of low-cost repayable loans that are provided to building owners who might not have an incentive otherwise to make their buildings as energy efficient as possible. And this usually starts with making sure that the building is properly insulated and then going through the building and replacing outdated appliances with modern appliances, and appliances like geothermal heat pumps can be powered by clean energy from the sun, from the wind, from geothermal power plants also, and
mm-hmm.
which generate no climate-disturbing greenhouse gases.
But let me ask you, that sounds really good for the new buildings that are coming forward, but what about the buildings we already have?
So I think that what we have to do for those buildings is we have to have a national climate action plan, which I like to call a national climate prosperity plan, because when we make these shifts in our energy use and become more energy efficient. That's almost synonymous with energy thrift. And the savings that we make by using clean power then can be reinvested in our economy. They can help lower individual household utility bills or the utility bills of businesses and school districts and so on. And with these 106 million residential and commercial buildings, and maybe 110 million if you include industrial buildings, we have to set a target, a certain number of actually millions of buildings. We have to begin that process of every year, let's say, if this were to be done over 30 years, perhaps 3.5 million buildings a year would have to be renovated and brought up to high energy efficiency standards. And we have plenty of capital in this country. There's tons of capital sitting on the sidelines, trillions of dollars. Mm. And if that money is properly incentivized by smart government programs, it will come in and it will profitably invest and lend the money needed. And this will produce millions of jobs that can't be outsourced and that can be provided to local areas where jobs might be needed and where local economic activity would be appreciated. Does that begin to make sense?
Yes, but it's going to take a while for this to sink in. So I'm a definition person. So let's just start with this definition. Please define what clean energy actually is. What is clean energy?
Well, clean energy is energy that doesn't require the burning of fuel. When you burn fuel, you produce carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a heat-trapping gas that destabilizes the climate. And when you burn a fossil fuel like coal or oil or natural gas, two-thirds of that energy is wasted as heat, typically, and only one-third is converted to electricity. And there is also a large loss of energy in heat when you burn oil in the form of gasoline in your car. And only a small fraction of the energy in the fuel is transferred to useful energy that reaches the drivetrain, moves the two-ton vehicle and the 100 to 200-pound adult driver. So,
but what if you have a gas stove?
What if you have a gas stove? I mean, there's no problem in replacing a gas stove with an induction electric cooktop that will actually heat faster than a gas stove, but it's also going to be safer, and it's not going to be producing nitrogen dioxide. It's not going to be producing a flame, which also produces airborne contaminants. Believe it or not, there have been studies that show that the fumes from a gas stove actually aggravate childhood asthma and can cause other respiratory problems. There are other pollutants that are they're trace elements in the natural gas, but when you burn it, it then becomes airborne. And the typical solution is just to vent it out of the house through a fan. And that does work. It does work. But it's not the technology of choice because the natural gas leaks, and natural gas is methane, which is 82 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide over a period of 20 years. So I'm not sure if I'm – these are such complicated questions that the answers tend to be long. I don't mean to be running on and on, but I just want to make sure that I don't give a misimpression to the listeners.
Right. Well, I mean, I have a six burner gas stove that was added onto my house, you know, over 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, And so that's why I was asking just from a personal position. But maybe you could, so you've explained what clean energy is. How is that different from renewable energy?
Well, it's actually the same thing. Clean energy is not is energy that is produced without combustion. And for example, when a wind turbine produces electricity by the blades moving and turning the armature in the generator and producing direct current or alternating current, you have power that goes into the grid without the necessity of burning fuel. And it's renewable in the sense that the wind is blowing today. It may be intermittent, but it will also blow tomorrow and the day after because it's caused by the unequal heating of the Earth's atmosphere. Similarly, the sun is going to be shining tomorrow. So in that sense, the flow of energy is perpetual. And
I see.
We say it's renewable because the sun goes down today, but it'll come up tomorrow morning, even though the sun is always there. It's just the Earth turning that makes it seem like the sun is going down and the sun is coming up, if you follow what
I'm
saying.
Right. Well,
yeah. So does that make it clear that it's renewable? Because just like, think about the rain. Rain falls, the water is collected behind a dam. Then when the water flows through a turbine generator to a lower elevation, the potential energy in the water is converted to electrical energy. And that, too, is considered renewable because of the successive rainfall in the watershed. So that's another example. Then the heat of the Earth is not absolutely unlimited, but it's such a vast quantity that for all practical purposes, as long as we're here on Earth, the Earth is going to be hot in the center, and that energy can be captured to produce electricity or hot water. And so that, in a sense, is considered to be renewable as well.
Interesting. Well, let me ask you, you had mentioned at the very beginning about concrete, and I'd like to know, what about green steel and green concrete? What are they, and do you see them as part of the solution?
Well, absolutely, because when you make steel today, we're using antiquated technology that involves a blast furnace that has to be heated up, let's say, to 1,500 degrees centigrade, and that's heated by coal. When that coal burns, it produces carbon dioxide. And also, coal is refined to a substance known as coke. And when coke is introduced into the blast furnace in order to remove oxygen from iron oxide ore to produce iron, there is also the production of carbon dioxide. It's a kind of intrinsic part of the old style manufacturing of steel. It's possible to do what Boston Metal is doing today, which is to electrolyze the iron ore and send a very powerful electric current into the iron ore to basically melt it and simplify the whole process of steel making so that you can get the iron without the blast furnace and without certain other components that currently are used in the making of steel. There's a basic oxygen furnace, and there are other processes that you can basically eliminate. And steel, if memory serves, produces on a global basis about 9% of all of human industrial emissions. So if you can eliminate combustion, eliminate the coal or the natural gas in the steelmaking process and use electricity that is made by the wind or by the sun or by geothermal power or from hydropower, then you're like way ahead of the game. And conceptually, you could eliminate this 9% of the burden of greenhouse gas by just changing your process from the dirty old conventional way of making steel to the new way of making steel. And of course, course, the steel itself is not literally green, but just terminologically, we refer to it as green steel or green cement. And cement making also involves the use of a kiln to heat limestone. And then as the limestone dissociates and produces lime, there's a production in the kiln of carbon dioxide. And when the kiln, which also has to be heated to a very high temperature, is heated, it's usually heated with coal or natural gas. These are the cheapest fuels available. And therefore, there's an intrinsic chemical production of greenhouse gas in the kiln and outside the kiln to heat it up. You can greatly reduce this by doing what Solidia Cement and a number of other cement-making technologists and companies are doing by reformulating the cement so it doesn't require such high temperatures, and some processes may be possible without even great elevation in temperature. And then the other thing that they're doing is some companies are injecting CO2 into the concrete as it is setting.
Oh.
And that can be done so that the concrete itself binds to CO2, the carbon dioxide, and basically turns it back to limestone. And so it keeps it out of the atmosphere and reduces the emissions. So there are various formulations. This is a lot of, there's a lot of complicated chemistry that goes into this.
Sounds like it.
But ultimately what you're doing is you're greatly reducing the carbon footprint of cement making. And cement making, like steel making, is a huge gobbler of energy on a global basis. Maybe it's 8% or something of that, on that order, of all of the industrial carbon dioxide that's made. So with steel and cement, if you take those emissions off the table, you have made a huge dent in the production of industrial greenhouse gases.
Well, let me ask you a question. Excuse my interruption. I just
want to
have some clarifying questions here. So my daughter happens to work in the construction industry, and I'm assuming that wherever these contractors do their major buildings, that they are getting this green steel and this green concrete. That's what they're using. I mean, that's available for everyone that's in the construction world.
It's not really available widely. We're not at the point yet where we have where it's the dominant commodity. And to the extent that it's available, and unfortunately the answer to your question is complicated, but we can make steel using hydrogen instead of coal. But that only really works with very high-grade iron ore, and it only works with scrap iron. So your choices are these sort of specialized feedstocks to the steelmaking process. Although Boston Metal is sort of gearing up to begin producing industrial-scale electrolyzers to produce steel, it's not yet available. But the way this is going to become pervasive is if cities and states require a certain proportion of the steel have a low carbon footprint. Initially, the footprint will be lower. Eventually, some of these companies will be able to produce basically zero carbon footprint steel.
Interesting.
And
all right.
Cement maybe is a little further behind. I don't think that we have a technology right now that's commercially available that could zero out the carbon footprint of cement. But you can get lower carbon cement, and to the extent that we write these requirements for green building materials into construction contracts, we begin to create a market for them, and that market demand can pull the production process forward.
Okay, well, let's move a little bit from the steel and the concrete, and let's talk a little bit, because I am keeping an eye on the clock, and I know that I have a lot of things I wanted to ask you, so I'm going to have you kind of condense your answers just slightly. So talk about the transportation for a minute. What are some of the green solutions in that sector?
Well, one green solution is to use, let's say, electric trains instead of trains that are running on diesel. And that's something that other advanced industrial countries have done, but we just haven't made the policy decision to do it and invest in the transformation of our railroads so that the railroads run cleanly and don't create fossil fuel pollution. And that's in terms of, you know, we have in the Bay Area where I live, we have BART. It's basically electrical. It's a sort of heavy-duty subway, if you will. It's not always underground. It's electric. And so to the extent that people will ride public transportation and not go and drive their gas-burning cars, that protects the environment. People today can shift very cost-effectively to electric vehicles. We have electric transportation for basically cars, light trucks.
You see that everywhere
heavy
now.
Trucks. And if you look at the economics, the life cycle cost of operating an electric vehicle is lower. And the front end cost, the first cost in the showroom, is beginning to approach parity. And that's why we're already at probably 10% of all new vehicles are electric, and probably by 2027 or 28, we'll see 20%. And so this is growing rapidly because the diffusion of clean technology happens as a result of the response of individuals to their own financial incentives. People, by and large, they may have altruistic impulses, but when it comes to making financial decisions and large energy purchases, they look for the cheapest solution for them. And I'm not sure.
It's interesting. I just want to interrupt for a moment. I live very close to where Google is located here in Playa Vista, and it's like when I walk by Google, I feel like I'm walking by a Tesla car industry. There are more than just Teslas listed there. I mean, there, but everybody that's parked there is plugged in, and it is interesting that you're seeing more and more and more electric vehicles, which means that people aren't putting. I'm assuming that means they're not putting gasoline in their car. Is that correct?
Well, if it's a plug-in hybrid, they might still be using some fuel. But because probably 80% or more of all of our trips on average are less than 10 miles in duration, we could use the electric component of the plug-in hybrid. So we would just be running on electricity most of the time.
I see.
The other thing to point out is that there are many, many forms of micro-mobility that don't require so much energy, and we're usually overdoing it when it comes to our vehicles. You always see people, one person in a large SUV, for example, it's totally unnecessary to be toting around 2 tons of steel and aluminum and glass when you could have a much lighter vehicle, or if it's a short trip, the solutions could be maybe an electric scooter, maybe an electric bicycle,
see a lot of those.
Maybe an ordinary bicycle. And we need to be engineering our cities so that they enable people to travel safely by these other modes of transportation, because that would give us an opportunity to greatly reduce our climate impact, if you see what I mean. And it's also in own self-interest, because people who bicycle over the course of a lifetime generally Their life expectancy is about 7 years longer. They're healthier, and usually they're in a better frame of mind because they've had some exercise.
Yeah, you know, but unfortunately, when you live in big cities, as I do, as you do, you know, getting across the city where you're driving on the freeway for 35 or 40 minutes is not going to allow you to go by bicycle. So that, there is that.
I agree with you. And what I'm just saying is that you need to consider downsizing a lot of these vehicles. Also, they're so big and high off the ground that when they do hit a pedestrian, it's much more likely to be fatal because they'll be hitting them in the midsection of the body as opposed to maybe hitting them in the legs. So these vehicles are they're just kind of like tanks on wheels.
Right, they are. Not to mention they blind you because their lights are so bright. I want to ask you, in your book, Solving the Climate Crisis, you call for a national climate plan, a scenario for our energy future. Can you just briefly tell us what that would look like?
Yes. We would study the problem, and this has been already studied by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and we have probably 14 other national laboratories. We need to basically begin with specific targets for reducing our greenhouse gas emissions as a society, and using careful computerized resource modeling and planning, we need to develop scenarios for what are the best regionally appropriate mixes of clean energy technology that will get us to net zero release of greenhouse gases as quickly as possible and as cost effectively as possible. The solutions will be different in different regions of the United States. Some regions like the Southwest are rich in solar energy, and that might be it might be that in the Midwest, the regional plan would be to draw heavily on wind energy, or there might be parts of the West where geothermal power might be used, and there are revolutions happening in geothermal energy technology, so that gradually hot rock is also going to be an exploitable energy resource. So the plan.
I don't know what hot rock means.
Well, underneath the soil, there is the hot mantle of the earth, and the core is molten, but then solidifies, and the heat from the core of the earth diffuses upward through the rock. And the rock is very hot at depth. And if you drill deeply enough anywhere, you'll come to hot rock. And the depth of the rock differs depending upon the local topology of the earth. But if you put a well down and then another well nearby and inject water down one well and recover the water up the other well, it will be hot. And that heat can be used, depending on temperature, for a whole variety of purposes. So I get back to the National Energy Plan. This would basically get the United States to a clean energy future on the shortest, cheapest possible path. And it would also show what the costs were and what the resource requirements were. And so it would vastly improve our ability and the alacrity with which we could get to a clean energy society. It would also show the costs and benefits of this too, so that people would have a better understanding of the ultimately trillions of dollars that we would save by relying on energy that didn't require burning fuel, because what we're doing now is we're setting fuel on fire every day, and then tomorrow we have to buy more fuel. And you can see that if you use a clean, renewable power source, you're not buying any fuel. It's fuel-free, So it has to be cheaper over time, especially once you've amortized the initial capital cost of building the solar power plant or the wind farm or the geothermal well or the hydropower plant.
Well, when I think about fuel, besides just our own personal use, you know, what comes to my mind based on where I live, which is just a few miles from LAX, what are you going to do for airplanes?
There are already electric planes that are suitable
really?
For short hops, and that can carry, you know, say up to 15 or 20 passengers.
Oh, yeah, but that's not going to get you across the country.
That in itself doesn't need to actually get you across the country. I mean, you could use electric air travel even today for local, for short hops and for medium range. Let's say you were going from, I don't know, New York to Savannah, Georgia, something like that,
oh.
or from,
mm-hmm.
you know, or maybe from Georgia to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how the diffusion of electric air travel will begin. But then it's also possible to use biofuels that are not as desirable as electric transportation, but they actually have a higher energy content per volume, so that you can produce bio-kerosene, for example, and substitute it for aviation kerosene, and you can fly an airplane on a biofuel that was manufactured using captured carbon dioxide from the effluent of a factory that's burning natural gas or coal. You can transform that into carbon monoxide and the carbon monoxide into ethane or ethylene, and then process that into aviation fuel, basically kerosene. And this is being done. There's a company called 12. It's a small company that I visited in Berkeley years ago. They just recently got $675 million of new investment because they're working with another company called Lanza Tech to produce aviation fuel. And this is already happening, and planes are flying using some biokerosene. That can be expanded. I'm not truly a deep expert on aviation technology, but there are these renewable alternatives. And the thing about biofuels that people might find interesting is that when you take a plant or let's say sugar cane, and you turn that into an alcohol fuel, and then you burn the alcohol, the amount of greenhouse gas that you release from burning that sugar cane or some other commodity is going to be precisely the same as the greenhouse gas that the plant took out of the atmosphere during its growth phase, and it does that through photosynthetic processes. So therefore, using biofuel conceptually can be a net zero carbon process, although there's transportation involved and there's other imperfections in this system. So you would produce some greenhouse gas, but a lot less than if you used fossil fuel.
Let me ask you, so people are listening, and this is very scientific. I'm going to be honest with you, a lot of this is up and over my head. But what can individuals do today to make a difference when it comes to the climate crisis? What are some suggestions that you might have?
Well, the first suggestion I have is to educate yourself and those around you about the climate issue and how we are disturbing the climate and what the implications of that are and why this is an existential crisis. The next thing to do is to look around and find people and organizations who are already working on these issues, and not to try individually to solve the climate crisis by wearing a hair shirt or carrying a hemp bag or just recycling a bottle, because this is a societal crisis and systemic change is required in order to solve this problem. So we have to work collectively on it. And one thing that people can do is cast their vote for candidates that understand the climate issue and that are committed to doing everything possible to avoiding further damage to the climate, because we can get to the point where our social institutions and our safety nets fray and we're unable to maintain a civilized society, because the world is getting very, very hot already and extreme weather is getting more and more extreme. We have one presidential candidate now who denies climate
change. Let's try
not
to make this too political, all right,
Okay, but I'm just saying that some candidates consider this an issue and other candidates consider it a hoax. And if you want to do something to protect the climate, we have to have people in office who are committed to using clean energy technology and energy efficiency. Because otherwise, we are basically not going to make progress, and the situation is going to get worse, and it will remain worse for your lifetime and my lifetime unless we take very, very significant corrective action.
Well, let me ask you, so where does the money come from to make this happen?
Well, the money is actually there. There are institutional barriers to spending that money. But when you have correct policies, you tip the incentive structure so that people make more money using clean power. And throughout the United States, in most of the red states, people are adopting clean energy, wind power plants, solar power plants, because they are making money. Farmers can have wind turbines and graze their cattle underneath the wind turbine and have another source of major agricultural income that stimulates the rural economy. We have trillions of dollars of capital in this country, and when a financial crisis comes up, the Fed is capable of buying trillions of dollars of mortgage-backed securities and doing all other kinds of financial manipulation. But because the country has not conceptualized and understood the climate crisis as a true existential catastrophic crisis, the funding has not been provided to provide these incentives. And when I say policy drives incentives, for example, if there were a carbon fee and dividend program in the United States, which the fossil fuel industry has blocked for decades, that would add a fee to anyone polluting the air at the wellhead or the mine, and this would cause fossil fuels to become relatively less desirable compared to clean energy and alternative technology. So it would drive the transition, the inevitable transition, I might say, to clean energy even faster. Does that make sense?
Well, I guess. And so what are some of the myths about climate change that you're trying to dispel?
I actually wrote a book about that called Climate Myths, the Campaign Against Climate Science. And the myths are that climate changes naturally, that we're just seeing a natural fluctuation in climate, that humans aren't responsible. The myths have evolved over the years, and the fossil fuel industry has perpetuated these myths, basically following the playbook of the tobacco industry, where they deliberately sow confusion about climate change, and they have paid climate hacks who go out, and they have PhDs often, but they receive large amounts of money from the fossil fuel industry, and they will say and do virtually anything to help confuse the public. And then we have media that is basically in the thrall of the fossil fuel industry and other very wealthy industrial interests that like to portray climate change as either a hoax or a non-issue or something that will get better on its own. But I would refer people to that book. It's called Climate Myths, The Campaign Against Climate Science. The science is very clear, and there have been many studies of research on climate change, and they find that even though the fossil fuel industry tries to make it a false equivalence between the climate doubters and the climate scientists, there's 99.999% of the scientific community agrees with climate science, and there are a few like cavemen out there with PhDs, let's say in Cave Junction, Oregon, who don't believe it and make a lot of noise, and then the media tries to amplify those few voices and create doubt and confusion.
Interesting. It's interesting. And by the way, I will be including your website with your books and things in my blog when this podcast is over, so that people can see the variety of books that you have written on this subject. You mentioned agriculture, and I think that's a very interesting subject. I don't know what regenerative agriculture is. What is that?
Well, it's a series of processes by which the farmer or the rancher actually regenerates the soil. And the soil is an ecosystem. And the soil receives energy from the sun via plants and plant roots. The plants capture carbon dioxide from the air, and also there are nitrogen-fixing bacteria on the roots of plants that take nitrogen out of the air and fix it or put it into a stable compound that is basically fertilizer for the soil and the ecosystem. So a regenerative practice by improving the soil improves soil fertility, improves tilt, improves water holding capacity, makes for healthier plants and for healthier animals and for healthier people who eat the food grown in a regenerative way. And the processes by which this is done involve something often no-till, no plowing, and it obviates the need for fossil fuel fertilizer, for herbicides, for pesticides, because when you have a healthy ecosystem in the soil has natural biological defenses against pests. And there's, because the soil, when it's healthy, has natural biodiversity, there are natural enemies to pests. And so the ecosystem stays in better balance.
What's that natural energy? Let me interrupt you there. So what are those natural energies? I mean, enemies, I should say.
I said natural enemies, meaning, one bug that will eat another, to put it simply.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. And so there's less need to rely on pesticides or herbicides. And what a regenerative farmer does is to always keep roots in the soil. Why is this important? As the plant takes carbon out of the air and nitrogen out of the air and puts it into root tissue, at some point that root, which penetrates in the soil, will die. And that organic material that was produced by the plant then can be incorporated into the soil. Also, the healthy plant grows more vigorously, has a more vigorous root system, and those roots share nutrients with the fungal community in the soil. And so the soil is enriched by the activity of these fungi. Some of them produce natural pesticides to keep the whole system in balance.
Mm-hmm. There was a you know, obviously a very large lawsuit against a particular company that I'm not going to mention that was using pesticides, and that was quite some time ago, right? To correct some of these problems, and people got very ill from that. If I remember, am I remembering that correctly?
I'm not sure that I know exactly what the particular incident is, but we have tried as a society in the United States to move away from certain pesticides, which were found to be very detrimental, not just to insect mm-hmm. life, but also to birds, because they bioaccumulate in the food chain. And when
right.
birds eat them, their shells become thin. And so this was causing the loss of peregrine falcons and the loss of bald eagles. And that was,
mm-hmm.
I'm referring, of course, to DDT, which the ecologist Rachel Carson blew the whistle on back in the mid-1950s. To the extent that we can avoid dousing the land with pesticides and herbicides, we can keep the water that flows off the land healthier and keep from damaging aquatic life with pesticides that run off
true.
The land. Yeah.
I've thought about the aquatic life.
It's all an interrelated system. And
mm-hmm.
basically, keeping roots in the soil and a cover crop on the land means that, let's say, a rancher can have a herd of cattle or sheep
uh-huh.
graze off the cover crop. And as they do, they will, as they migrate over the land, leave natural fertilizer there. And that basically can replace synthetic fertilizer produced from natural gas. And so you
sure.
have a win-win situation. You're feeding the livestock. You're keeping the soil healthy without the plowing and keeping the cover crop on the land. It greatly improves the water-holding capability of the soil. So if you're doing dryland agriculture in the, let's say, in the Dakotas, you can do it more successfully and have a higher yield and healthier crops than if you were trying to use sort of conventional, sort of brute force factory farming and using the industrial agricultural model that I was describing with the pesticides and the herbicides and the plowing and all of that disturbance to the land.
Do you see that this is international?
It is being done internationally. It's not limited to the United States. I mean, it's kind of related to organic
mm-hmm.
agriculture, where
mm-hmm.
in organic agriculture, you are not using pesticides or herbicides, but you might not necessarily be using all of the other regenerative processes. But what's top of mind in regenerative agriculture is viewing the soil as an ecosystem and trying to ensure its viability and health. And once the soil is really healthy, it'll look black, almost like
really?
black cottage
huh.
cheese. And that's
hmm.
because it's rich in carbon. And the soil that is rich in carbon is going to be rich in nitrogen as well. And so you can look and see a soil that has been subjected to industrial agricultural processes will tend to be lighter and have a less clumpy consistency and maybe will be light brown or sandy or something of that kind, and less able to retain water, less rich in nutrients, and less able to support biodiversity. And, of course, with
mm-hmm.
biodiversity comes the multiplicity of insect life, and insects support birds, and, you know, the whole ecosystem rests on soil, on land, just like there's a whole marine food chain and ecosystem mm-hmm. out in the ocean and in lakes. So there's a lot of benefits, mm-hmm. as I mentioned, in terms of water conservation and in terms of protecting the health of wetlands and protecting the health of streams and rivers.
Right. So in these last few moments that we have together, if you could just name something that you're really excited about right now, what would that be?
Well, I'm very excited by the fact that we have all of the technology that we need to rapidly transition to a clean energy economy. And doing this would create millions of new jobs. It would save trillions of dollars. It's really a no-brainer. And we just have to get the obstacles out of the way. And people need to understand this. So the more you learn about this, the more you will see what you can do at every level. You can do things at the municipal level. There are city climate plans. You can do it in your place of work. You can make your home energy efficient. When you make an energy purchase, make sure that if it's a big one, that it says energy efficient as possible mm-hmm. and that it's capable of interacting with renewable energy systems. So in addition to voting and getting your neighbors to vote and staying engaged, going to town halls, pestering your congressional or senatorial or local representatives mm-hmm. to find out what is their policy on climate change and what is it that they propose to do, and let them know that it's really an important issue to you and that if they are not going to be properly aligned with clean energy, that you'll find somebody else to support, or maybe you'll run for office yourself. So people can be politically engaged.
Have you ever thought about that for yourself?
Oh, I don't really.
What did your wife?
I
think you're married, right?
Correct.
Okay, so what would your wife say if I was to ask you, so, John, are you thinking about running for office? What would she say? Oh, my God.
I would say that I think other people can do that job much, much more successfully than I ever could. And I think that we have to play to our own strengths. And I have been blessed with an ability to handle words and language and mm-hmm. to write in a way that people respond to. And I think it would be foolish for me to try to be somebody else and do somebody else's job, if you understand where I'm coming from.
I do. I do. I could see you doing a TED Talk, though. I could see you on a stage.
I wouldn't mind to that. I would be happy to do a TED Talk, which is very different from running for office.
That's much different, absolutely. I actually know somebody that works with people that like to do TED Talks because I could see where being on a stage in front of an audience that's there because they're really genuinely interested in what you have to say, you know, or speaking to college classes. Do you go and speak to colleges?
I have done that years and years ago, but mm-hmm. I just find that the world has become so virtual that it's not really easy to go out and find an audience in real time. People are glued to their screens and I don't know that they're going to talks very much anymore. I think I can probably reach more people by, for example, just as you mentioned, the TED Talk is a good idea. And
uh-huh.
I actually do a great many interviews and talk to a lot of people on radio and on podcasts. Uh-huh. And I expect that I'll do more of that. And I'm going to give a talk this afternoon to another group.
Wonderful. I guess I could just see you at a university. You're in San Francisco area. I could just see you going into a university's classroom and speaking on the subject to people like yourself that are truly interested in this subject. And you're a pro at this. You're an expert in this. I would think that would be desirable, but just something for me to consider because you're speaking to an audience that already has an understanding of what it is you do. I think you might inspire somebody to want to follow in your footsteps.
Well, that's very kind of you. Actually, I'm hoping that people in classrooms and that professors will adopt Solving the Climate Crisis as a book for their classes. It's a good text. In some cases, students have written to me and said that they read it and it changed their life and they decided to go into a career in renewable energy in one way or another.
I think that's terrific. I think that's great because you, John, you never know who's listening that might say, this is precisely what my son, my daughter, myself, my spouse, this is precisely what I'm talking about. We need to delve deeper. And you've written a lot of articles. And you, like you mentioned, you've written this last book isn't the only book you've written. You've written multiple books. I think you've written 11 books already. So I just want to thank you for taking the time to delve into this very important topic. I appreciate you sharing your expertise with our listeners very much.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. And I might say in terms of what's next, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to find major financial support for a national conference on removing barriers, let's say barrier busting, to a clean energy economy.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have all the technology, and we know it works, and it just needs to be scaled up and made more widely available. And there are things that are stopping us in every domain. I've tried to write in Solving the Climate Crisis about the technological, ecological, and economic clean energy transition. But in each one of these domains, there are obstacles that need to be overcome. And I think if we could focus as a nation on the urgency of all of this, and if we could have a national emergency declaration from the White House, which a number of other countries have done, and thousands of other less, exalted governments, municipalities, for example, and states have declared climate emergencies. I think that would help us as a nation prioritize this issue and focus on it and give it the resources and attention that it requires. So that's my hope in this conference, which I'm sort of at the moment still struggling with, but I'm talking to people at Stanford and talking to people at World Resources Institute.
Wonderful.
And I'm hoping that I can pull the support together to make it happen.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your time today. I've appreciated taking the notes on what you've talked about, and I will certainly encourage our listeners to check out your book and the other books that you've written. And I just want to thank you so very much for being my guest today.
Well, it's very kind of you to invite me. I really appreciate it. It's good talking with you. I'm glad that you felt it was helpful.
It was. All right, everybody. I'm saying goodbye to John now. Remember, we're not related, even though his last name is Berger, and that was my maiden name. Just had to throw that in there. All right, everybody. Bye for now.
Okay, I'm getting lunch delivered. What's everyone want?
Well, I'm gluten-free.
Uh-huh.
Vegetarian for me, please. Veggie guy.
Vegetarian, got it.
I'm allergic to nuts.
No nuts.
Oh, hey, I'm fee-free.
Sorry, fee-free?
Yeah, I don't put fees into my body. My body is a temple.
Okay, but how do I order delivery without fees?
Postmates. No delivery or service fee on orders over $50.
Order from the best restaurants in L.A. Totally fee-free on eligible orders over $50. Only on Postmates. Offer terms and exclusions apply. See app for details.
Save on family favorites at Vons and Albertsons. This week at Vons and Albertsons, get selected varieties of Yoplait Original Yogurt, 4 to 6 ounces, for just 37 cents each with digital coupon. Limit 12. Plus, get Grapery Cotton Candy Grapes for $3.97 per pound with digital coupon. Also this week, get value packs of Bone-In Signature Farms fresh whole frying chicken, drumsticks, or thighs for $1.49 per pound with membership where applicable. Visit Vons or Albertsons.com or head in store for more details. Deals.